This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Secret Swiss bank accounts aren't what they used to be. This week, Swiss bank UBS agreed to provide the U.S. government with details of more than 4,000 accounts. The IRS is going after clients suspected of hiding funds in UBS banks in Switzerland. Robin Farzad, senior writer for Business Week, joins us now from member station WLRN in Miami to talk about this and other economic news. Hi, Robin.
Leanne, thanks for having me.
Sure. Are you pulling all your money out of that secret Swiss bank account?
Oh, you know me. Yeah, Living like James Bond.
That's right. My secret account is the piggy bank under the bed. but talk a little bit about this, because this is, I mean, Swiss banks have been really notoriously tight-lipped about their client list. It's almost a cliche. What happened?
It is almost a cliche. If you say something like, well, he was known to carry several Swiss bank accounts, it immediately confers this kind of a mysticism or international man of mystery and danger. And a lot of that was de-exoticized this week when UBS was forced to give up just under 5,000 client names. And that's the unthinkable. If a Swiss banker were to just volunteer names, I think that's punishable by a prison sentence in Switzerland. So sacrosanct are the secrecy laws there. So this shows you how much that was shattered in just a matter of a few days.
Yeah. So what happens to the clients and to the banks themselves?
The clients are going to fight this tooth and nail, but a handful have already fessed up and said, we are guilty as charged. And the government, in addition, the United States, put through some sort of amnesty project and the carrot and stick tradition, because the signaling is more important. In addition to getting their back tax revenue, I think it's going to make other firms step forward and find IRS religion and say, look, we're going to take you up on your amnesty offer. And so the government gets a two for the price of one. It gets to flex its muscles and show that nothing is above the U.S. law, especially where Treasury is concerned. And two, we can look forward to indeed getting more revenue down the line now that their wall of secrecy has been shattered.
Let's talk a little bit about the markets this week. Did you see dark clouds or a silver lining?
Well, the market, however monolithic we want to look at this thing, is at a year high. I mean, this has been a spectacular run, if you think about it. I saw a stat somewhere that over the span of time where the economy hemorrhaged 2 million jobs, the market's gained 50%. That's unprecedented. And this is the best, I think, 6 or 7 month run since 1938. So it shows you how far we've come from a perception standpoint. Back in March, people really thought that we were on the brink of absolute abysmal calamity. And what's noteworthy is that riskier asset classes have outperformed the safe and stable security. So that flies in the face of this whole reckoning argument that we've been so chastened that people are going to be husbanding cash under their mattresses for the foreseeable future. So at least that's promising, but maybe we've gotten a tad ahead of ourselves.
There were new numbers from the Mortgage Bankers Association this week. More than 13% of American homeowners with a mortgage have either fallen behind on payments or are already in foreclosure. What effect is this having on the U.S. economy as a whole?
It's a significant overhang going forward. We, as an economy, really binged on housing, really had this almost this real estate new paradigm fetish. And I don't think that kind of excess inventory is going to be worked off in a year or two. We have several other shoes to drop in terms of delinquencies. There's a certain level of amnesty right now between the banks and delinquent borrowers for them not to foreclose, for them to maybe seek out remediation. And you're going to see a lot of these things fail over the next year or two. The question is, how much has the market already priced that in? The market was pricing in, once again, calamity just a few months ago. And now it seems that things aren't going to be as horrific as expected. So it remains to be seen.
Robin Farzad, senior writer for Business Week, joined us from member station WLRN in Miami. Robin, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Leanne. My pleasure.
The government is putting the brakes on its popular Cash for Clunkers program. After 8 p.m. tomorrow, car buyers no longer will be able to trade in gas-guzzling vehicles for rebates ranging up to $4,500. Congress authorized $3 billion for the rebate program, and consumers flocked to overwhelmed dealers. But while dealers could barely keep up with demand, questions remain about the program's effect on Mother Earth. Professor Michael Girard joins us by phone from New York. He's the director of Columbia Law School's New Center for Climate Change Law. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's your assessment of the program's effect on greenhouse gas emissions?
The program has been wonderful for the economy, but it's been only a middling success for greenhouse gas emissions. The minimum required difference in the mileage for the old vehicles that were traded in and the new vehicles that were bought was just 4 miles per gallon, which is not much of a difference at all. In reality, people were buying better than that, and so the average differential turned out to be 10 miles per gallon. Which is much better, but it is still not a cost-effective way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
You don't consider it cost-effective, and it also didn't have an effect on the environment.
Well, it had a very, very small effect on the environment, much smaller than many other expenditures would have. There's some calculations that it costs somewhere between $200 and $400 per ton of carbon dioxide reduced. That's way above the market price of carbon and way above many, many other methods of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Can you explain what you mean by the cost of carbon? I don't understand the equation.
There are some existing cap and trade systems around the world that trade in carbon. In the northeastern states in the United States, we have the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and carbon dioxide is selling there for about $3 a ton. In Europe, under their trading system, under the Kyoto Protocol, it's around $18 or $20 per ton. So cash for clunkers at $200 to $400 a ton is not a good deal for the environment.
Could the government have run this program so that it had a more substantial environmental impact?
There are two particular things the government could have done. First, it could have required a greater mileage differential. So instead of a minimum of 4, and you could have had a minimum of 15 miles per gallon differential, which would have made a big difference. Secondly, there was a provision in the law that automobiles, vehicles over 25 years old, could not be traded in, and that made no sense from an environmental standpoint.
I had read that you said the government should provide low-interest funding so industrial companies can make their individual boilers more effective.
There are lots of far more cost-effective ways to reduce greenhouse gases. The increase in the energy efficiency in the industrial sector, increases in energy efficiency in commercial lighting and residential lighting, all would be several orders of magnitude more cost-effective from a fuel-saving and greenhouse gas perspective than Cash for Clunkers was.
Do you think it would have made a difference if the government had extended the Cash for Clunkers program even longer?
Well, it would have cost the government a lot more money. It would have sold more cars. It would have made very little marginal environmental improvement.
Michael Girard is director of the Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School in New York. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Homeowners facing foreclosures aren't the only ones with housing problems. Federal funding for the nation's largest rental assistance program, Section 8, could dry up for some housing authorities before year's end. The shortfall has forced some low-income families to pay higher rents and put others in jeopardy of losing their vouchers altogether. As for the hundreds of thousands currently on multi-year waiting lists nationwide, New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein reports they will have to wait a little longer.
Over the last several months, housing authorities across the country have had to make life harder for their low-income clients. The New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority cut aid, forcing people to pay more in rent. Executive Director Dean Kristen doesn't like to squeeze people who on average make under $15,000 a year, but he says that's better than the alternative.
Obviously, it puts an increased burden on those households, but it is an option that is short of obviously terminating assistance.
Terminating assistance is a polite way of saying pushing people off the program. The only reason that option's on the table for some agencies is because congressional funding didn't fully cover Section 8 costs this year. To deal with the shortfall, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, is tapping money set aside for emergencies to pump $130 million more dollars into the program. But Doug Rice of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities doubts that will go far enough.
Many local programs will be assisting fewer families at the end of this year. During one of the deepest recessions in decades, the program really ought to be assisting more families, not fewer.
Dick Dunphy directs the Manchester, New Hampshire Housing Authority. He says while his deficit is a huge concern, that's not what keeps him up at night.
In 2001, I recall going over to City Hall and reporting that we had 1,900 families on our waiting list. Currently, we have over 10,000.
I asked Dunphy how long someone towards the back of the line has to wait.
Your household may well be looking at an indefinite wait.
What does that mean, an indefinite wait?
Well, it means we don't know when, if ever, we're going to be able to assist you.
Manchester isn't alone. Just listen to these numbers from some housing authorities. In Houston, 19,000 people are on a wait list that could take up to 3 years. In Washington, D.C., there's an 8-year wait for the 28,000 families in line. The number of people on the Section 8 wait list with the New York City Housing Authority, 127,825.
Better go back in the AC? Get your nap in?
Back in New Hampshire, Sherry Saley has been on the Section 8 wait list for over 3 years.
When I signed up, my daughter was walking. Now she's not. I'm trapped on a third floor, needing their help so badly, and there's no funding available.
Saley's facing simultaneous emergencies. She's going through divorce and won't be able to afford her place anymore. But even if she could, she wants to move because of her daughter's deteriorating condition. Sam's got what's called FOP, where bone grows over her muscles and joints, restricting her ability to move. The 16-year-old, who weighs 67 pounds, gets around in an electric wheelchair and depends on an array of machines to keep her alive. This spring, doctors said she had 24 months left. It takes Saley an hour with all that equipment to get Sam outside. That includes Saley cradling her daughter as they go down 3 flights of stairs, a nurse trailing with Sam's life support system in her arms. All that means the teenager gets outside about once a month.
What do you want, Sam? What do you want to see happen here?
To be able to live on the first floor and make new friends and hang out with my mom and dad. And get to be able to play outside.
Sam's prognosis jumps the Saleys to the front of the Section 8 wait list, but still no voucher is on the horizon. So once the divorce is final, Saley will try to find a place she can afford out of the $1,200 a month she gets from welfare and disability.
We're living every day trying to figure out how to grow it faster.
HUD's Assistant Secretary Sandra Enriquez says she would love to be able to shower vouchers on the Saleys and all the other families who need help. But right now, she says, the department's first priority is to ensure no one loses their vouchers due to the shortfall. She says she's confident by year's end, housing authorities will serve the same, if not more, people than in 2008. But realistically, Enriquez says those wait lists won't be getting shorter anytime soon. For NPR News, I'm Dan Gorenstein in Concord, New Hampshire.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Have you ever wondered, what would Harry Potter do? Well, it turns out dozens of religious scholars are asking that very question. After years of being pilloried by the Vatican and conservative Christian groups for, among other things, promoting Satanism, the boy wizard is getting a second look by those very groups. And academic journals are teeming with new interpretations of J.K. Rowling's series as Christian allegories.
The line of the plot definitely follows the gospel.
That's Professor Una Eisenstadt, chair of religious studies at Pomona College and author of one of those recent studies.
She has two Christ figures, Dumbledore and Harry, each of whom die a kind of death, experience a kind of rebirth, and she has two Judases, Snape and Malfoy.
Professor Russell Dalton, who teaches at Bright Divinity School in Texas, wrote a book called Faith Journey Through Fantasy Lands, a Christian dialogue with Harry Potter, Star Wars, and Lord of the Rings.
One theme that's very present in Christian theology, that all of us are fallen. And so there's the scene where the sorting hat is put on Harry's head, and he whispers to it,
"Not Slytherin."
And the sorting hat tries to convince Harry. He says, you could be great in Slytherin. You could become this a great evil wizard. Harry chose not to take that path.
The wand seems to me to represent God the Father. The stone, which confers resurrection, represents the Son. And the cloak of invisibility clearly stands for the Holy Ghost.
You're on a quest to find your identity, but also to combat evil. You're called to something greater. You find out that you have powers that you did not know that you had.
Did you ever make anything happen?
Anything you couldn't explain when you were angry or scared? You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard.
But in case you thought Harry Potter's been co-opted by weighty intellectuals, Professor Eisenstadt says not to worry.
Don't get the idea that I didn't enjoy these books. I love these books. I love them, and I love to think critically about them. For me, it's just an extra added layer of delight.
400 years ago next week, an Italian inventor unveiled his latest creation to lawmakers in Venice. His name, Galileo, and his invention, of course, was the telescope. To mark the occasion, we turn to Robert Williams. He's the new president of the International Astronomical Union, and he says we're now in the midst of a golden age in astronomy.
A golden age. It is a confluence of some of the discoveries in the past decade or so. We now know that black holes do exist, as exotic as these things are, and that our Milky Way galaxy actually is a host to a massive black hole in the center of the galaxy. We know definitely that other planets exist around other stars. And we know now an amazing fact, really, that the universe is not only expanding, which we've known for almost a century, but it's speeding up. We'd always thought that it would be slowing down because of the universal attraction of gravity. So you go to a cocktail party, you know, you sit down on an airplane, you talk to the people in the seat next to you. Everyone finds what we are discovering about the universe fascinating at this time.
You made headlines in 1995 after you were given 10 days with the famous Hubble telescope. You decided to point it at a seemingly blank patch of sky, and you came up with something that we now call the Hubble Deep Field, a section of sky that revealed 3,000 galaxies. Take us back to that moment. What were you originally after?
I was after the same thing I was after when I grew up in Southern California, got a paper route when I was 12, 13 years old. First thing I did with it was buy a little telescope, and I took it out in a dark night to see what I could see, particularly as the faintest, furthest things. 50 years later, I had a larger telescope, still felt it was important to do the same thing. I'm a risk taker. And basically, we were taking a risk by using the telescope to point it at a blank area of sky and see what we could see. But I had enough confidence that something interesting would come out of that I thought it important to do. The fact is, we did find galaxies more than a lot of people predicted, and therefore it moved back the epoch of galaxy formation earlier in time.
At the rate of discovery now, what do you expect to be discovered before the end of your life?
We have currently in science no way of knowing what preceded the Big Bang, or even if it makes sense to talk about what happened before it, because again, time is something that is intimately tied up with the nature of matter, and we don't know what that was. But given the rate at which discoveries have been made, even during my lifetime, I bet that within a century or two, we may well find a way to get information about the state of the universe that preceded the Big Bang. That, to me, would be mind-boggling.
Dr. Robert Williams is the president of the International Astronomical Union, and he's with the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. He joined us from member station WYPR in that city. Dr. Williams, thank you so much.
My pleasure.